Coming up next on Tech News Weekly, it's me, Jason Howell, my co-host, Micah Sargent, and we got a lot to talk about today, starting with Texas HB 20. This is the law in Texas that is now in effect, impacting social media networks and impacting their ability to moderate content on the platform. Plus, how to solve the pipeline problem to better utilize Black tech workers in the workforce. Grubhub's free lunch promotion gone seriously awry. And finally, how drugs like fentanyl, dangerous drugs, are being sold pretty easily on social media. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 235, recorded Thursday, May 19th, 2022. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Barracuda. Barracuda has identified 13 types of email threats and how cyber criminals use them every day. Phishing, conversation hacking, ransomware, plus 10 more tricks cyber criminals use to steal money from your company or personal information from your employees and customers. Get your free ebook at barracuda.com/TNW.
And by Podium. Join more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interactions. See how Podium can grow your business. Watch a demo today at podium.com/twit.
And by Zentry Security. Remote work is here to stay. Zentry Security's Zero Trust Private Access solution is a modern cloud-hosted alternative to a VPN. Enhance your security posture today. Try Zentry Trusted Access with a 30-day free trial by visiting zentrysecurity.com/twit.
Hello, and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
And I'm the other guy, Jason Howell. Good to see you, Micah. Thank you so much for covering for me last week. COVID was not nice to me, so I really appreciate you stepping in last minute. I know it was very last minute.
That is A-OK. We got through it, and we're back together again virtually this week. So we're good. We're good.
That's right. Right on. Well, let's get things started. Certainly, you've heard all about, you know, everything going on in Texas with content, you know, around content moderation, HB 30. Content moderation on its surface, at least to me, and I think to a lot of other people, feels like a necessary tool in just keeping the internet safe, and oftentimes from literal harm in many ways. But there's a law in Texas right now that was recently allowed to pass through on an appeal after first being shot down late last year. And it's really taking aim at the foundation of content moderation and scales out from there. And as with everything these days, it's very political as well. So joining us to talk about this is Mukund Rati, attorney and just all around knowledgeable guy on this subject from Electronic Frontier Foundation's Stanton Legal Fellow as well. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. I'm a longtime Twit fan.
Oh, right on. I love it when we hear that. That's great. That's a good bonus. So thanks for hopping on. We're happy to get you on today. And we love the work that the EFF is doing. So it's good all around. So let's first of all talk a little bit about the genesis of this, because it's really, you know, everybody's, you know, in the technology press right now, everybody's talking about this now, but this isn't the first that we've heard about this. It kind of happened late last year, I think around October timeframe, where this first popped up. Talk a little bit about the beginnings of HB 20, what exactly it is, how it ultimately came to life, and then eventually got shot down late last year.
Sure. So HB 20 finds its origins in a lot of the controversy over content moderation. As you said, a lot of people see content moderation as a necessary practice on the internet in order for people to find the information they care about and to stay away from the information they don't want, the speech they don't want to see, and things that are legitimately harmful to many people. Of course, there is also a lot of controversy over this moderation, and especially a lot of the big platforms like Facebook, Google, which owns YouTube, Instagram, which is owned by Facebook. And not just that, but also Reddit, Pinterest, any number of platforms use content moderation in ways that are controversial. They take down speech that many people feel should stay up. And many different groups of people have claimed in the past, rightly in many cases, I think, that this is discriminatory and that errors are being made. And so HB 20 is a law that Texas passed. And when Governor Abbott signed the law, he said very openly that this is intended to protect conservatives from discrimination. And he kind of hearkened to this idea that these are big Silicon Valley monopolistic liberal companies that are stifling the voice of the little guy, the conservative in Texas. And whatever one thinks about whether that's actually happening is besides the point as far as the law is concerned. The law is very clear. The First Amendment makes it very clear that companies, whether they run online platforms, whether they publish a newspaper, whether they have a television show, whether they're doing a radio show, they have the right to say certain things or not say other things. They have the right to host certain speech or not host other speech. And the government cannot say one way or another whether, the government can't interfere as far as that practice goes. Again, whether it's we're going to publish this in the newspaper or we're going to host this on our online platform. What HB 20 does is precisely that. It tells platforms that have more than 50 million users, so it is focused on large online platforms. It tells them that they can't discriminate when they do content moderation on the basis of the viewpoint of any user. So it's hard to know exactly what that means. It's written very broadly, but what we can imagine, especially based on what Governor Abbott said about protecting conservatives, we can imagine that, say, someone posts something that repeats what many consider to be misinformation about the last presidential election. If the platform takes that down but allows up other information about the 2020 election that says that the election was legitimate, that President Biden is the correct president, then that platform could be sued for viewpoint discrimination. So that law was passed, but before it went into effect, the government was sued by an association of technology companies on the basis of their First Amendment rights. And a federal district court in Texas entered an injunction finding that the law violated the First Amendment and prevented it from going into effect.
All right. And then that kind of brings us to the now, which suddenly, very suddenly, it seemed, it was undone in appeals court, essentially. And here we are in a situation where HB 20 is, I mean, it's in effect, but are we seeing the effects of it yet on social media networks? And I'm sure they're scrambling to figure out, like, what do we do as a business, in the state of Texas if this continues to go forward? But are we starting to see kind of like the chilling effect of that?
Everyone definitely is scrambling. And what's happened, just to give a little bit of background, what's happened is that the Texas government appealed that district court decision up to the appellate court. Both sides submitted legal briefs. They went to court and they each argued their case. And that appellate court entered a very short one-sentence order saying that the injunction entered by the lower court was stayed. So what that means is the law could go into effect. And as far as, practically speaking, it is now in effect in Texas. And so what that means is technically when platforms, if they moderate content, and to be clear, we're not just talking about taking down content. What the law defines as prohibited content moderation or censorship is basically any type of content moderation. That can mean if you demonetize something, if you deprioritize it, and it's unclear if it would even apply to things such as, very commonplace things that platforms do, which is they try, at least from their point of view, from what they say, they try to show us content that appeals to what they believe our interests are. If someone indicates that they're not interested in your post on the election and the platform then chooses not to show you that post, that could fall into what the law defines as prohibited censorship. So that law is practically speaking in effect right now. We have not seen any lawsuits filed. What the law allows is for the Texas Attorney General or any internet user in Texas who believes they've been discriminated against to file a lawsuit. So we haven't seen that yet. It's entirely possible that that could drop any day now before, you know, up until the Supreme Court takes action, hopefully. As far as whether we've seen chilling effects, it's hard to know. You know, one of the, you know, there are many issues with content moderation, one of which is that it's not a transparent process. We don't always know what's going on behind the scenes at these companies. When they shift their practices of content moderation, it's not always immediately apparent. We only learn if, you know, we begin to see aggregate effects, or if there's some leaked document from a company saying that, oh, you know, we decided to make this shift and what content we allow or don't allow. But without a doubt, these companies are definitely scrambling. And to be honest, you know, so are we, and so is much of the legal community and the community around free speech, because this is such a, frankly, legally outrageous event that's happened.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing you kind of go into a little bit deeper detail as far as the broader implications, because I hadn't really considered this before. What you're talking about really makes me think that on the broader scale, something like this might have impact on just any like AI. AI is making a ton of the decisions behind the scenes to say, hey, this person wants to see this, this person doesn't want to see this, or even this, we want to protect this person from the harm that they face by seeing this. And if that is in any way shaping what someone sees on the other end, what you're saying, from what my understanding is of what you're saying, that could be construed as preventing someone from seeing something that that they should be able to see, whether it's harmful or not. And that just makes me feel like the people behind the law, like, are they just not considering deeply enough kind of the associated chaos that comes with an unmoderated platform as far as that's concerned?
It's very hard to get into the minds of these or any politicians and try to figure out what exactly were they thinking when they did this. Again, you know, the messaging around this law from Governor Abbott and in the Texas legislature was that we are trying to protect conservatives from discrimination by the big liberal tech companies. Of course, they did not write the law in that specific of a way. They did not say you can't discriminate against conservative viewpoints. I think that would have been maybe even too obviously unconstitutional for them. What they said is you can't allow viewpoint discrimination. And so there is maybe an argument to be made that viewpoint discrimination does not include all content moderation. For example, let's say a platform has policies around, you know, limiting content that promotes negative thoughts or even suicidal sharing of suicidal thoughts or suicidal encouragement. We all know that that's a very big problem, especially for young people using social media, that kind of negative thinking and suicidal thoughts can spread. Many platforms say, okay, we want to protect young people from that, so we will stop content that encourages suicidal thoughts. Is that viewpoint discrimination? Is that discriminating against the viewpoint of people? And this is obviously terrible, but you know, when it comes to free speech, we talk about a lot of terrible things. Mm-hmm. Is that discriminating against the viewpoint of people who do encourage suicide? Because unfortunately, there are such people. You know, in a sense, that certainly could be true. And so in response to that, platforms may say, okay, we are going to stop all content that discusses suicide because we don't want to be accused of viewpoint discrimination. So whether it's someone sharing suicidal encouragement type of content or someone who's trying to educate people about suicide and about mental health awareness, platforms may decide to avoid allegations of viewpoint discrimination. Let's stop all of that content. So that could be one effect of the law, whether it was intended or not by the politicians, that platforms will simply start taking down more content because they don't want to be accused of viewpoint discrimination. On the other hand, as you said, it's also possible that platforms will choose to moderate less. They'll say, okay, we don't want to be accused of viewpoint discrimination, so let's not take down anything. And again, you know, this is, it's really hard to picture what exactly that would look like, because just to reiterate, we're not just talking about taking down content. We're talking about basically any type of content moderation, including just basic curation. What order do things appear in your feed? That is something that, you know, platforms obviously spend a lot of time deciding. And all of those decisions seem to also be covered by this law. So it definitely does open up all sorts of possibilities. as to what could happen. And it's hard to imagine, to be frank, it's hard to imagine that the politicians that passed this law imagined that it would actually go into effect. I have to imagine that even they were surprised that the Fifth Circuit let it go into effect as it is now.
Yeah, which is amazing when you really think about it. Like, let's violate the First Amendment and just see what happens. So how is the EFF fighting this explicitly? Like, what are you doing behind the scenes to move towards that outcome, to where this law goes away? Because I assume that's the stance that you know from everything that I've read from what you guys are putting out there. But what's working behind the scenes?
Yeah, so the EFF has always, as I said, we've always supported the right to moderate content as protected under the First Amendment. We've always said that governments cannot interfere with this right, whether it's the large platforms or with the smaller platforms that we often don't talk about, but who are ultimately affected in the downstream effects of these kinds of laws and regulations. And we think that's a really important part of how the internet operates, is that users should be able to go online, find a platform that fits their needs. Different platforms have different approaches. Some are more allowing of various types of content. Others are more restrictive. It's hard to find a truly unmoderated platform where anything is allowed. And the few examples that we have of those are often notoriously rife with hate speech and racism and so on. But we think it's important that the internet be a place where users can find and even create their own platforms with different such policies. So what we do, as a legal organization, one is we provide assistance to internet users who want to stand up for their rights. More often than not, the social media platforms who are facing these kinds of laws are well able to defend themselves on their own. But EFF will discuss, the First Amendment issues with the legal community to come up with strategies. We also file what's called amicus briefs in the courts. These are briefs submitted by third parties with an interest in the outcome of the case. So in the case of this law, HB 20, as I mentioned, it first went before the federal district court in Texas, then up to the appellate court. It's now up at the Supreme Court. And at every stage, EFF has filed a brief saying, here is why, as an organization that stands up for internet users, we think it's important for platforms to have these First Amendment rights and be able to exercise them. Because in the end, we do think that users benefit from an environment where everyone has that right and where the government doesn't get to dictate what happens.
Yeah, indeed. And that's why I really appreciate the work that you all of you at the EFF continue to do. So I really enjoy having you and bringing you on the show, Mukund Rathi from the EFF, EFF.org. If people want to follow the work that you're doing individually, where can they find you?
Ironically, I try to stay off social media most of the time. I use the internet plenty. But the best place to follow EFF is to go to EFF.org. You can do some internet sleuthing if you want. I think I have a Twitter account somewhere that I probably post to occasionally. But EFF.org EFF.org is a great resource. Well before I worked at this organization, I followed their news. We have a blog, Deep Links, where we publish regular updates on our take on what's happening in the tech and legal worlds.
Right on. Well, thank you so much for carving out some time for us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was great being on. Great talking to you.
Absolutely. And best of luck. All right. Up next, Black representation among technical workers. And, you've probably heard of it, the pipeline problem. Mike is going to get into all of that with our next guest. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Barracuda. In a recent email trend survey, 43% of respondents said that they've been victims of a spear phishing attack. But only 23% said they have dedicated spear phishing protection. Maybe that needs to be a little bit more. How are you keeping your email secure? That's the question. Barracuda has identified 13 types of email threats and how cyber criminals use them every day. Phishing, conversation hacking, ransomware, plus 10 more tricks cyber criminals use to steal your money from your company, of course, maybe your personal information from your employees, your customers, and you. Are you protected against all 13 types? Well, email cybercrime, it's becoming more sophisticated. Attacks are more difficult to prevent. I mean, they're pervasive. They're everywhere. Attacks use social engineering, of course, including urgency and fear, which is very effective to prey on victims. Social engineering attacks include spear phishing and business email compromise. It costs businesses an average of $130,000 per incident. And then as demand for COVID-19 tests increased at the start of 2022, Barracuda researchers actually saw an increase in COVID-19 test-related phishing attacks. That increased by around 521% between October and January. Always looking for kind of the ripe moment to jump, and that's exactly what we have there. As public interest rise, for example, in cryptocurrency, the opportunity for attacks become ripe as the price of Bitcoin increased by almost 400% between October 2020 and April 2021. Barracuda Research also found that impersonation attacks grew 192% in the same period. And then in 2020, the Internet Crime Complaint Center received 19,369 business email compromise and email account compromise complaints with adjusted losses of over $1.8 billion. So securing email at the gateway level is not enough anymore. It's still important to leverage gateway security to protect against traditional attacks, things like viruses, zero-day ransomware, spam, and other threats. But your gateway is defenseless against targeted attacks. So protection at the inbox level, including AI and machine learning, that's all necessary to detect and stop the most sophisticated threats. And you can get a free copy of the Barracuda report that's 13 email threat types to know about right now. And you will see firsthand how the cyber criminals are getting more and more sophisticated every day and how you can build the best protection for your business, for your data and people with Barracuda. So find out about the 13 email threat types you need to know about and how Barracuda can provide complete email protection for your teams, your customers, and your reputation. You can get your free ebook at barracuda.com/TNW. That's barracuda.com/TNW and check out that ebook for yourself. Barracuda, your journey secured. And we thank Barracuda for their support of Tech News Weekly.
So you may have heard that tech has a talent pipeline problem. You may have even heard that big tech is trying to hire more Black workers to different fields. And you may have heard that that is slowly improving. But despite the work that's being done, there still does seem to be some disconnect, something that is happening where what they are trying to do is not happening. Joining us today from Protocol is Amber Burton, who has looked into this and is joining us today to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Amber.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it is a pleasure to get you on. So I want to talk first about kind of laying the groundwork here, because you know, we've heard different stats about underrepresentation, but I think that the research that you included in this piece from the Pew Research Center really kind of spells it out for us. Can you talk about underrepresentation of Black technical workers, please?
Yeah, it doesn't really get any clearer than what Pew has found in its research. And really what it comes down to is the numbers show that it's really remained quite stagnant in terms of representation for Black tech workers, but underrepresented workers in tech as a whole. And so, you know, Pew looked at, you know, Black workers make up 11% of all employed adults in the United States. But, you know, compared to that, when you get into STEM, 9% of that representation is Black workers. And it gets even smaller when you kind of drill down into, you know, if you look at engineering, it's about 5% representation of Black tech workers. And so it gets kind of smaller and smaller, but really those numbers have stayed quite stagnant. Pew found that there's been no change in the share of Black workers in STEM jobs since 2016. And that's really been quite consistent with what we're seeing at Protocol. You know, I report on DEI, but reskilling and upskilling and training as well. And so a lot of our work is digging into those, you know, big impact reports that these big tech companies release every year or twice a year and looking at their numbers. And we've been tracking them for as long as a lot of these big companies have been releasing them publicly. And when you drill down into, you know, Latinx, Black workers, a lot of those numbers have stayed right around the same that they were several years ago.
So then let's, so basically what that shows us is that yes, these numbers have not changed. And one thing that comes up whenever a company is asked about what's going on here is this idea that there is a, quote, talent pipeline problem. Could you please describe or tell us what that means? If someone says those words, what is it that they're suggesting when they say those words, that there's a talent pipeline problem?
Yeah, it really almost feels like a buzzword these days. We hear that all the time and you start to wonder, okay, well, what is the pipeline problem? So what they're really talking about when they say that is that, you know, the talent that they were hoping to be readily available and there to enter into these, in this instance, highly skilled tech jobs, is not there. And so whether that be the skilling that needs to be done, the training, or, you know, people coming through certain college programs, they're saying that the amount of talent is not there and that more training needs to happen. And so it's really quite interesting because you have the idea that there's not enough diverse talent coming through the pipeline. But then there's also the idea of, you know, it being more of a leaky pipeline. Some of the experts that I talk to talk about it in those terms. The K4 Center did a recent report looking into diversity in tech, and they term it as the leaky pipeline. And, you know, it's really looking at, you know, where are Black, tech workers kind of falling out of the pipeline, or Black students who might be on track to go into this field, where are they kind of falling out? And where are the holes that's maybe preventing them to get into the door? And then, you know, maybe one answer to what is the pipeline problem that might be a little bit less satisfying is there are a lot of experts questioning, is it a pipeline issue? Is it more so a closed door? It is something mm-hmm. that some people are starting to think about that's preventing people before they even get into the interview seat or pass that screening interview, you know, what's really happening there. So I know it's kind of a squishy answer at times. It is a buzzword now, but yeah, that's the pipeline problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and what you're pointing out is kind of where I was going with that, in the sense that we hear about this and it is starting to sound like an excuse as opposed to being, you know, this is the actual real deal complication that exists here. You spoke with the NAACP's Director of Education, Innovation and Research, Ivory Tolson, about HBCU recruitment efforts. So these are efforts to solve for this talent pipeline problem by recruiting at HBCUs. And Tolson, I liked this, likened the problem to a glacier. Could you explain what was meant by that? Why is it like a glacier?
Yeah. I mean, using it as in that way also helps me really understand it as well. And you could also maybe picture it as a pyramid. So that's really talking about how those easily identifiable schools at the top, you know, your Stanford, your MIT, your Ivy League schools, that's where a lot of these tech companies kind of go directly to, you know, where they already have a network. There's going to be a smaller percentage of Black and underrepresented students who are coming through, you know, a computer science program there. But that's where they're going. And so if you look beyond that level and you then look at HBCUs, you're going to get a larger level of Black, you know, computer science graduates. And if you go beyond that, you're going to get to, you know, your state universities, your two-year institutions and community colleges, your technical training colleges. And you're going to get an even larger number of underrepresented employees that you could possibly choose from. And so if you think about it as it's getting wider, you know, the further you get to the base, that's where you're seeing most of the talent. But if you're only looking above that surface level, that top of the glacier, what you see, you're going to get a smaller number. And, you know, the challenge with that is you're really dependent on these schools and their diverse recruiting efforts. If you're really solely relying on those pools of talent, whereas if you look beyond that, the further you go, the further out you go in terms of where people haven't traditionally proactively recruited, that you're going to get more underrepresented quality possible job candidates as well.
Mm-hmm. So just to clarify or to confirm, basically in this situation, these big tech companies are saying, we're doing recruitment, we're going and we're looking for folks, but what they're doing is they are looking for Black candidates at Ivy League schools or well-known technical colleges, and what they are, they're looking for them there, and they're finding some and they're hiring them. But what experts are saying is, if instead of only going to these places that you typically go to, if you would start looking in these, even all the way out to state schools or specifically technical colleges, that you would be able to find more candidates. And so it's almost that they need to expand the pipeline. They're working with some very thin pipe. And if they would just open it up a lot more, then they would have a lot more candidates they could pull from. Yes.
Yeah, that's correct. And I like that idea, expanding the pipeline. And it's not to say that they're not looking at these schools. You know, they are looking at state schools and HBCUs, but it's more so, are they proactively looking? Are they, you know, putting just as much investment in time recruiting there as the top schools that they usually go to as well?
Got it. So then this is where that question comes up. If there are loads of initiatives and programs out there that are aimed at better representation, then what is it that's keeping those initiatives and programs from having an actual impact on job numbers? This is, you know, a larger question outside of just the glacier or the pyramid or the wider pipe. There's sort of specifics that you mentioned in your piece about what experts are saying needs to be changed in order for this to improve.
Yeah. It's really about scale. I mean, so it's not to say that these partnerships that do exist with HBCUs aren't necessarily effective. You could question that in many different ways because they're all very different. But what it really comes down to scale. I mean, a company might have an initiative that partners with 100 students. And that's really great and really impactful. But when it comes to those thousands of applications that are, you know, flooding into a company every day, it's not quite clear that Black and underrepresented candidates are having that same level of success. And so it's really about that scale. And if companies aren't really intentional, there can be that disconnect between the people who are spearheading and leading these internal HBCU partnerships and the people who are doing the day-to-day hiring, those hiring managers who are interviewing and selecting candidates. They're often two different people within a company. And so if you don't have more of that kind of connection, you're definitely going to see a disconnect.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. You mentioned deep work as the solution to this pipeline problem. What is it exactly, you know, when they're talking about deep work, this is kind of this larger, the scaling, of course, but also a conceptual shift and a culture shift that comes into play. What all is involved with that deep work that needs to be done? And because of the fact that it's deep work, do you think that that then has an impact on companies who are saying, we're trying to make these changes, but we're trying to do them while remaining on a budget? And deep work is something maybe that they're afraid of having to do for the bottom line.
Yeah, absolutely. So deep work can look like a few different things. And so I spoke to Allison Scott, who's the CEO of the Kapoor Center and heads a lot of their research as well. And she really mentioned, you know, that deep work could look like a really engaging partnership in which you partner with an HBCU and you bring them on, you know, almost in an internship capacity in addition to training, and it leads to employment. That's more deep work when you know that it's going to lead to employment. And we spoke to Accenture, who has a partnership with Prairie View A&M University, and they kind of function more like that. So their version of deep work, for example, is, you know, they partner with a cohort of students. They bring them into what they call a co-op program in which, you know, they bring them on as full-time employees, but they do that training and that skilling. They give the students access to all of their resources and employees for networking, but really, at the end of it, it turns into full-time employment or an internship for the students involved. And so you see a real actual reaction to that program. Another form of deep work that she really talked up was, you know, we often talk about, you know, just throwing money at a problem might not be the best solution. But in this case, a lot of experts are saying, no, invest your resources into these schools because they have that proven track record that they can produce really great graduates that could come in and work for these big tech companies, you know, but they're often the most under-resourced schools. And so, you know, donating money if you can, if it is in the budget, donating money actually goes a really long way in terms of sustaining these programs and making sure they not only stick around, but can grow and feed more, you know, highly skilled workers into your company. And then another thing that was, you know, really talked about in terms of deep work was, you know, connecting with the presidents at these universities, having the very real conversations of, you know, what does it take to get more, you know, of our students into the doors of these companies. And I think something that's a little bit maybe indirect deep work is making sure that your company does have that inclusive culture, and that's free. Making sure your company has that inclusive culture that once these underrepresented employees come in the door, they not only feel welcome, but they want to stay. And so we've seen a lot of, tech companies who've had issues where, you know, they're doing that work, they have these partnerships, but internally, you know, they're dealing with a lot of issues in which employees aren't staying, or there, you know, there are allegations of harassment or things of that nature. And so, you know, resolving those internal issues is also part of the deep work too.
Absolutely. And by the way, for listeners out there, our audience is largely white. HBCU stands for Historically Black Colleges and Universities. So as we've been talking about HBCUs, I just wanted you to be aware of what that meant if you weren't aware. Now, the last thing that I was curious about, you mentioned specifically Level Up as one of these programs for, I believe, Accenture. Were there any other programs that did have the positive outcome that you shared as an anecdote at the beginning of this piece that you found in your research, or was Level Up kind of a real standout here?
Yeah. So Level Up's a real standout, but you're right. Like, other companies do have this. It's really interesting. Like, a lot of these companies have kind of been in the game for, you know, experimenting with different types of programs for about the past decade. So Apple has several partnerships and programs that function in different ways, anything from, like, you know, their scholarships and internship programs. But they also have partnerships with HBCUs. And then I think one of the most recent ones that there were a lot of headlines about, of course, was, you know, AWS partnered with Howard University, and they're more so focused on, you know, they have a master's program for data science in cloud concepts. And so that one's a little bit younger. So, you know, we haven't quite totally seen all of the outcomes yet, but that one has been, you know, very highly touted as well in terms of not only, you know, bringing the resources in the curriculum, but doing the on-the-ground training as well.
Understood. Well, Amber, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to join us here on Tech News Weekly. Of course, folks can head to protocol.com to check out the work that you're doing. But if they want to follow you online and see your great work, where should they go to do so?
Yeah, they can find me on Twitter. Of course, that's the main place I think where all of us are. But yeah, follow me on Twitter. That's where I post as many of my stories as I can.
And what's your handle there?
That would be Amber Bree.
All right. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Up next, we've got Jason Howell's story of the week. But before we get to that, I want to tell you about Podium, who are bringing you this episode of Tech News Weekly. If you own a small business, you know the past couple of years have been hard. Heck, you don't even have to own a small business to know the past couple of years have been hard. From supply chain issues to increased demand on top of everything else that business owners have to manage, the businesses who are thriving right now are the ones who are forward thinking. Podium helps your small business stay ahead of the curve with modern messaging tools that make it easy for your customers to connect with your business. A lot of people hate calling a business. It's me. I'm that person. I'm one of those a lot of people. Maybe it's the plumber, the landscaper. Look, having to play phone tag, and all you would rather do is just send a quick message. So if you're running a business and the only way to get in touch with you is a phone number, you may be losing people. Podium gives businesses the tools to compete with the convenience offered by bigger businesses like Amazon. I love the idea of being able to send a text and be able to set up an appointment, for example. It's more likely that I'm going to get my hair cut by you if all I have to do is send a text message to get that set up. And frankly, if I walk out of your business after I've done a thing, And I get a text message that's like, hey, you know, it'd be really awesome if you could give us a review on Google Reviews or something, then that too is one of those options to go in and actually do that thing. So I love the idea of those text messages coming through versus the calls that I'm not going to answer because I don't answer calls. From healthcare providers to plumbers, more than 100,000 businesses are texting with customers through Podium. While customers love the convenience, businesses love the results. One car dealer sold a $50,000 truck in just 4 text messages. A jeweler sold a $5,000 ring and coordinated curbside pickup all through these texts. And a dentist sent out payment requests through texts and received 70% of their outstanding collections in just 2 weeks. With Podium's all-in-one inbox, you can do even more than just chat. You can get more online reviews by sending an easy-to-use link. That's what I was just talking about. Collect payments fast from anywhere. Send marketing campaigns that actually get a response. And it's all through sending a quick text. See how Podium can grow your business. Watch a demo today at podium.com/twit. That's podium.com/twit. Podium, let's grow. Thank you, Podium, for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. Jason Howell, take it away.
All right. I hope you're hungry, because this is all about food right now. Or actually, it's more all about the lack of food, really, at the end of the day. Grubhub, I don't know if you heard about this, but they had the best intentions, or so it seems anyways. I'm sure this was all like, hey, let's throw some extra business at the restaurants that work with us. Let's feed people in New York City. They just didn't have a whole lot of foresight, apparently, because it didn't go according to plan. Grubhub had conducted a survey prior to this last Tuesday, where they discovered that many New Yorkers were skipping lunch. In fact, of those, you know, that returned the survey or participated, 69% said they're skipping lunch. So not a small number. That's quite a large percentage. And, you know, in Grubhub's mind, that's a possible opportunity to cash in on, I suppose. Grubhub, of course, is food delivery. They decided to do all of those lunch non-eaters a favor, and lunch was going to be provided just this last Tuesday for, you know, very specific time between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. For free, essentially $15 credit. People who redeemed the $15 credit to get the free food, they would still have to pay for tax and I think, you know, like tip if they're tipping on top of that. But $15 would cover the majority of that meal. So on Tuesday, they put the promotion into effect. And in the end, you know, ultimately, they were averaging around 6,000 orders a minute. It brought the system down at one point temporarily. Once they recovered and they tallied everything up, 450,000 lunch orders were tied to the promotion, which on its surface sounds like a pretty big success. Like, they got a lot of pickup from, you know, Grubhub users who wanted to get that free meal and use Grubhub in the process. Only they obviously didn't consider the logistical challenges of this. And apparently they didn't adequately notify partnered restaurants because, well, Grubhub's saying that we did let them know. Many restaurant owners had no clue. So if Grubhub did send that advance notice, they clearly didn't do it effectively. They probably could have done it in a different way that more restaurants would have noticed. But as a result, the restaurants weren't just, you know, busy with business. It wasn't just like Super Bowl Sunday busy. They were crippled. Like, many were just struggling to keep up with the demand. They couldn't fulfill all of the orders coming through, hundreds of orders coming through, like in a matter of minutes. As a result, you know, in the end, it ended up doing the exact opposite of what Grubhub was hoping for. Ultimately, many users did not get their food, or they got it hours late, delayed. And the real crummy thing about this is, you know, those customers who don't receive the food, they're less likely to really blame Grubhub for that. They're going to blame the restaurant for not providing what they paid for or what Grubhub paid for. And so in the end, like, I think I would imagine that all the intentions were good as far as this is concerned. I don't think Grubhub set out to, you know, give the restaurants a bad name. They wanted to do, you know, and the restaurants, to my understanding, they're getting paid from Grubhub for this. So it's my and actually, now that I say this, I don't know that I saw explicitly that they weren't paying for it out of pocket, but I'd be really surprised if Grubhub held a promotion like this and said, yeah, and you've got to pay for it, restaurants. So I'm assuming that Grubhub is paying.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're out. You know what? That would be weird if it wasn't that. But it's all of the cascading effects outside of that, right? It ties up the restaurant. You know, angry Grubhub users not, you know, wanting the food, not receiving it. So they're, you know, angry at the restaurant itself, creates food waste. There was tons of food that as a result, like it was made and then they would get the cancellations because it's been like an hour and a half. They can't keep up with all the orders coming in. So that food goes to waste. Violated the trust of the restaurant owners working with Grubhub. Mm-hmm. Who may or may not have chosen to actually participate if they were given the option, or if they were given constructive information around it, because it sounds like maybe there was some information, but it obviously didn't, you know, get through to a lot of restaurants.
This should have come with, like, they should have all gotten a box in the mail that when they lifted it up, there was like a spring-loaded thing of confetti. Yeah. And then there were like, wee alerts and sirens saying, hey, tomorrow you're going to be swamped. They should have sent a singing telegram person to every single house. Yeah, look at this photo of these.
Yeah.
That's awful. I feel bad for everyone involved.
Yeah, a photo shared on Twitter, which was just one of many. I mean, social media was just going nuts. And I mean, this photo in particular shows, you know, a ticket machine. And you can't even see the ticket machine. It is just a pile of printed receipts. A lot of the restaurant owners were saying, you know, they were getting hundreds of orders in a span of like 5 minutes. And, you know, these are small restaurants, a lot of them participating. This is another avenue for them to gain business. And so they work with Grubhub, but it's not like they have a kitchen of 30 to 50 employees standing by to make 100 meals a minute or whatever that comes out to. And so as a result, you know, some of the interviews that I read, you know, the people had no idea. It was like three people and they're training one person. And then suddenly this day happens and they literally say, like, this is busier than any Super Bowl Sunday I've ever worked. They're just caught completely flat-footed. And I used to work in the restaurant industry, so I can only imagine what, you know, I can put myself in that position. And oh my goodness, like, I'm so happy that I didn't have to experience it, but I feel awful for anyone who just thought they were going into a regular work day and they were faced with that.
Yeah, especially because, like, day to day, different places will have their rushes that are already kind of, you know, you sort of have to prepare yourself for them. And so I can just imagine a person's like, okay, you know, it's a Tuesday and, oh, Tuesdays at 9, those sure are, ugh. And you sort of get yourself ready with your water or the 5-hour energy you take right before it starts. And then to find out that that whole day you're going to be just, man. On top of paying for all of these meals, as Grubhub I'm sure did, they should be paying, like, I don't know, ridiculous tips to all of the restaurants at the very least.
And, you know, a lot of complaints from the actual Grubhub delivery people, because restaurants who were impacted, right? It's like they are, for right or wrong, the Grubhub delivery person coming through the door is the face of Grubhub in that moment when the restaurant is going, your company just, like, overwhelmed us, like, to a point that we can't keep up on, you know? So then they have to face that, or they go there for the delivery and realize it's canceled. Like, it just ensnarled everyone. And I know that Grubhub was giving out like 40% coupons to people who didn't receive their food, which, okay, all right, I guess it's something, but I don't know. It's just, I think ultimately, and, you know, they've even mentioned this, like, they did not consider the impacts of a promotion like this, and they're going to do better on promotions like this in the future. And I think there's a lot of ways that they could have done better, even though at the core of it, like, good, you know, like, I appreciate the sentiment. Hey, y'all aren't eating. Let's feed you. We're going to pay for it. But just executed really poorly. Like, I don't know. You got a lot of changes to make to do that successfully next time.
I'm disappointed, to be frank.
Yeah. That's an interesting story nonetheless. So there's a lot of stuff you can find on social media if you want to see kind of the impacts, you know, people sharing photos and videos of exactly the chaos that was going on in kitchens when all that was happening. But hopefully that doesn't happen again. So that's my story of the week. Up next, Micah, we're going to hear your story of the week. But first, let's take a moment and thank the sponsor of this episode of Tech News Weekly, and that is Zentry Security. Remote work. I mean, I'm remote working right now. I'm at home. It's here to stay. When the pandemic started, offices emptied. All of a sudden, everyone knew, you know, what something like a VPN was. The problem is that VPNs were designed many years ago for a much friendlier landscape, when the only threats you had to worry about were internet worms, for example. Well, times have definitely changed. Threat actors are specifically targeting remote workforces now. They see that as a ripe, you know, area for the picking, with sophisticated phishing attacks and exploit vulnerabilities in RDP. VPNs offer broad network level access, allowing east-west propagation for authorized users and unauthorized ones. Zentry Security is a perfect solution for small to medium enterprises. It allows only authorized users to access applications in the cloud and the data center without complex VPN clients, without a lot of configuration, and without all the associated headaches. Employees, contractors, third parties, regardless of their location, they only get application level access to specific apps and specific resources based on globally applied natural language policies that are defined by the IT admins themselves. So dispersed workforces get more secure. They get streamlined access to only the applications they need to do their jobs, just using a browser on their preferred device, in fact. Every connection is encrypted end-to-end, reducing the attack surface and increasing your organization's security profile. And so as a result, everyone wins. Users are happier, everyone's more productive and collaborative, and IT has a lot less to support. So they have less headaches as well. Enhance your security posture today. You're going to want to try Zentry Trusted Access with a 30-day free trial. All you have to do is visit zentrysecurity.com/twit. That's Zentry, Zentry, security.com/twit. Zentrysecurity.com/twit. And we thank Zentry Security for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right, story of the week time. Over to you, Micah.
It is time for my story of the week. Yes. So I wanted to, I was, you know, looking through the stories and the different headlines, and this one stuck out. And it's not a fun story, but it is one that I think needs to be talked about. And it is a story about fentanyl and social media. And, you know, when I've heard about these stories in the past, I'll be honest that I sort of had this reaction of the reaction that we have around Halloween when you hear different law bodies saying, hey, make sure you check your kids' candy because, and then they'll show you a photo where the edibles candy looks almost exactly like the candy that you can get from, you know, the grocery store. So the cannabis infused peanut butter cup next to the regular infused peanut butter, or the regular peanut butter cup. And what is the case, and what is this case in that situation, is that most of the time, no one is going to take their very expensive edibles and put them into Halloween baskets because they would rather keep those for themselves. And, you know, the argument right there is that, like, that is a situation that is so rare to actually happen, because if somebody has their cannabis, they spent the money on that cannabis and they want to use it themselves, not give it away. Yeah, and we're showing a photo now of Stony Patch Kids, Double Stoneo, Cheetos Puffs with cannabis, Fruity Pebbles with cannabis, and Nerds Rope with cannabis in it. And so those, yes, they do look a lot like normal candy, but the odds of someone actually putting them into a candy bucket instead of keeping themselves to eat is low. So when I think about dealers dealing drugs, I also, you know, if somebody's buying cocaine, I wondered, why would a dealer lace the cocaine with an expensive drug when they can just make money off the cocaine itself? Why would they want to spend more money and not get as much money in their dealing of said drug? And so I looked into the research surrounding fentanyl and its use in lacing drugs. And the truth is that people are lacing drugs with fentanyl. There are different reasons why they think people are lacing drugs with fentanyl, different suggestions. Some of the research that's been done is actually boots on the ground research, where these scientific researchers who are not law officers, and so they can go out and talk to dealers, actual dealers, and in some cases distributors, can talk to them without those people fearing repercussion. They can figure out kind of what their thinking is. And the thinking there is that fentanyl, well, there are kind of two schools of thought. One is that fentanyl is more easily available than some other opioids. And so in that case, being able to sell fentanyl is a lot easier to do. And the other school, which in the research that I've done, suggests that it comes more from not scientific research and more from just kind of people's general beliefs, is that these drugs are being laced with fentanyl for the purpose of getting someone hooked on those drugs so that the person comes back. But again, that one doesn't have as much backing in real science, more so than it's just the average person sort of trying to figure out their own logic for the situation. So I just want to make all of that clear before I talk about this actual piece, because there's a lot of information that is not backed by science or research or any of that when it comes to this, because we are talking about such a taboo topic, and it is hard to figure out how people are operating in this space, because they are doing something that's against the law. And so it is difficult to figure out, you know, true motivations and situations from that. So with all of that in mind, with that huge caveat that I provided before we get into this, now we can talk about it. What we're finding is that there's been an increase in the number of drug overdoses for people 18 to 45. In fact, overdoses are now the leading cause of what we call preventable death among people ages 18 to 45. That brings it ahead of suicide, ahead of traffic accidents, and ahead of gun violence. Overdoses are the leading cause. We've also seen a huge increase in experimental drug use by teenagers in the U.S. Overall, it's been dropping since 2010. But despite that, deaths from fentanyl have skyrocketed. So experimental drug use has dropped over time, but the deaths have gone up. In 2019, there were 253 deaths from teenagers due to fentanyl overdose. Just last year, it was 884. So I want to say those numbers again. 253 in 2019. Last year, 884. So this has absolutely increased. And what they are finding is that people are looking to social media, particularly Snapchat and other sort of ephemeral messaging platforms, to be able to find what they're actually looking for, which is Percocet, Xanax, and other similar pills. But what ends up happening, typical ADHD medications like Adderall. And there's if you scroll down a little bit on this page, this is a New York Times article. There's an image showing what oxycodone, which is an opioid, actually looks like. And then below it is a counterfeit oxycodone that has fentanyl in it. In the middle on the top is a Adderall tablet, and below is Adderall laced with fentanyl. And then on the right, which is a very popular drug at the moment that folks are after, is on the left, on the far right, the tablet on the left that's white is authentic Xanax. And next to it, which is in yellow, is a counterfeit Xanax tablet that contains fentanyl. And as the article points out, and as I mentioned earlier, again, one of the motivations behind using fentanyl is that because of its synthetic nature, it is easier to procure. Typically from Mexico and China is where folks are getting the fentanyl. And you don't have to use as much. It is incredibly potent in comparison. And unfortunately, there are now other synthetic versions, synthetic opioids. And there's a place where they named kind of what the different ones were. But one of them was, I think, 100 times more potent than average than actual fentanyl. And the other one was 10 times more potent than fentanyl. But that is part of the problem, is that these folks are getting these drugs. And so fentanyl on its own is 50 times more potent. And so you can use a lot less of it and tell someone you're giving them heroin, and it turns out you're giving them fentanyl. And if you don't know your measurements and things like that, you could end up very easily killing someone. And then in the case where they're using other synthetic options, those ones may be even more potent than fentanyl, which is already more potent than heroin. And so it just goes deeper and deeper and deeper. And the fact that these teens are able to use social media to find these, the whole piece kind of goes through and talks about different families who've lost their children to fentanyl overdoses. And in many cases, the children were not looking for opioids in the first place at all. In one case, they were looking for benzodiazepines. In another case, they were looking for methamphetamine style drugs, speed or ADHD medication, and ended up dying when they took these pills because they were laced with fentanyl. So ultimately, this piece talks about the different social media networks, Snapchat, it talks about Facebook, it talks about Instagram, and kind of a little bit more inside knowledge of how folks are using these methods to get to both distribute and find drugs. And I mean, in this one case, there was a 20-year-old man who was charged with the death of the kid that they mentioned in the first part of the story, with the anecdote that kicks off the story. Like 20 years old, distributing drugs and ends up killing someone and is then charged with, you know, murder. Yeah. Is just, it's horrible all around. And so I do encourage everyone to read this piece from the New York Times, not only for the sake of just knowing what's out there, but also especially if you're a parent or something like that, just a little bit more awareness. This, what I will say, like this piece did not have that, here's the lingo the kids are using these days. And if it says AFK, you know, that means away from keyboard. No, this is a piece that is more mindful than some goofy kind of hello fellow kids thing. This actually has, I think, trustable information that is actionable and would be helpful in any situation as a parent. So yeah, I just wanted to point out that it's out there. It's well worth reading, and it's very sad all around. It, like, for the kids, obviously, who have been killed from fentanyl overdoses, also for the kids whose lives are ruined from dealing these pills, when they may not know that there's fentanyl involved in it, it's just sad. Yeah. all the way around.
Yeah. Yeah. What you mentioned about like the lingo and everything like that, they do in this article link to something that, I mean, I, as a parent, find useful. It's by the Drug Enforcement Administration. It's the emoji drug code decoded. And it's essentially like, as we've noticed on social media networks that drugs are being sold, this is the emoji language that we noticed associated with it. Because again, it does go back to, like, me as a parent, if I happen to see something along these lines, you know, this pairing.
Yes.
Understanding that these symbols could be used in that way is helpful. Not that they always are. Like, there's a million different reasons why you would use a mushroom emoji for something. Mm-hmm. And then there's a drug reason. Yeah. You know what I mean? So, yes. I mean, yeah, just to be aware. But they linked to that. I thought that was kind of interesting to read through. I mean, you know, this sort of stuff permutates in and has for generations, you know, as far as how someone markets illicit drugs to people who are looking to buy them, and what that language looks like, and how it's, you know, is it done with burner phones and beepers, or is it done on social media? And right now, I mean, this is just where everybody is social media. So it makes perfect sense that this is being distributed and you know, it's interesting. One thing that's interesting to me is how do we tie this into the first interview that we had today, where there is this idea of content moderation, and, you know, from a platform perspective, the platform can take this emoji drug code kind of sheet as one example, and potentially there are clues there that would allow them to, you know, on one hand, protect users from buying fentanyl because they see the signs and, you know, a certain level of confidence that, as a result, you know, block that message or whatever the case may be. And how does that play with HB 20? And is this, you know, just something that's becomes a lot harder when you can't moderate your content on your platform? I don't know, but yeah, that's what comes to
mind. Yeah. That guide, I think the one failing of that guide is that they don't have they should have it for each platform. So because emojis can look very different for each platform. And I understand why they had to do it that way. It's because each individual emoji set is owned by the company. The artwork is owned by the company. So they may have not been able to do that. But in any case, I kind of feel like translating those for iOS, well worth checking out that piece, seeing some of the links that the New York Times links to, and just being aware overall.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. All right. Well, we have reached the end of this episode of Tech News Weekly. Thank you so much for watching and listening each and every week. We do this every Thursday. And if you go to twit.tv/TNW, you can find all the links to subscribe and audio video formats, jump out to YouTube, watch it there, whatever you need, twit.tv/TNW.
If you'd like to get all of our shows ad-free, well, you can. How? By checking out Club Twit. For $7 a month, you can get every single Twit show with no ads. You can get access to the exclusive Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else, and access to the members-only Discord server. That is a place where you could go and hang out with your fellow Club Twit members, as well as those of us here at Twit. This morning, I did a live chat with Jerry Wagley, our VP of operations, and we talked about what led him to where he is now. You can hear about how at one point he was going to be a meteorologist and how things have changed over time. Yeah, really, really cool conversation. All of that's available as part of the club. It'll go up on the Twit Plus bonus feed after it's out, which I believe it is out now. If it's not, it'll be out very soon. Twit.tv/clubtwit, $7 a month. Well worth it. And you also get that warm, fuzzy feeling knowing you're supporting us here at Twit. I should also mention that for folks who use Apple Podcasts, you can subscribe to the show directly. And all you have to do is in Apple Podcasts, look up Tech News Weekly, find the audio version of the show, and you'll see a button you can press. Subscribe for $2.99, and when you do so, you will get an ad-free version of the audio feed right there in your Apple Podcasts application. If you'd like to tweet at me, you can find me at Micah Sargent on pretty much every social media network. I try to keep my username the same, or you can head to chihuahua.coffee, chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. Check me out on Saturdays with Leo Laporte, where we host the Tech Guy radio show, taking your tech questions from all over the US and elsewhere. And on Tuesdays with Rosemary Orchard, where we record iOS Today. This morning, I got to see the upcoming artwork for iOS Today, and I'm really looking forward to the new show artwork. So, got to keep my lips closed on what it looks like and all of that, but it's pretty exciting stuff. Jason, what about you?
Yeah, well, you can find me on Twitter at Jason Howell. You can also find me talking about Android things on All About Android every Tuesday, twit.tv/AAA. And then working behind the scenes on a lot of Leo's shows and everything, as is Micah. Big thanks to John Ashley and Burke at the studio for doing so many things behind the scenes to make this show happen. We really appreciate your work. And we really appreciate you on the other side of this camera for watching and listening each and every week. We'll see you next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Did you spend a lot of money on your brand new smartphone and then you look at the pictures on Facebook and Instagram and you're like, what in the world happened to that photo? Yes, you have. I know. It happens to all of us. Well, you need to check out my show, Hands-On Photography, where I'm going to walk you through simple tips and tricks that are going to help make you get the most out of your smartphone camera or your DSLR or mirrorless, whatever you have. And those shots are going to look so much better, I promise you. So make sure you're tuning in to twit.tv/hop for hands-on photography to find out more.